Welcome to the Second Reading Podcast from the University of Texas at Austin.
The Republicans were in the Democratic Party because there was only one party.
So I tell people on a regular basis, there is still a land of opportunity in America. It's called Texas.
The problem is these departures from the Constitution, they have become the norm.
At what point must a female senator raise her hand or her voice to be recognized over the male colleagues in the room?
And welcome back to the Second Reading Podcast. I'm Jim Henson, director of the Texas Politics Project at the University of Texas at Austin. Now, we're recording on the afternoon of Thursday, September 4th. And as I sit here on Thursday, the House and the Senate both adjourned sine die last night, or maybe technically in the case of the Senate, I think this morning, ending a very contentious second special session. And presumably, though there's still a little bit of doubt floating around out there, ending a very, very conflictive, interesting, but again, very contentious 89th Texas legislature. And again, there are some reports that the governor might be considering another special, but I that is not widespread in their conflicting signals, and so we shall see. I kind of doubt it, and I shouldn't even say that, but you know, I wasn't positive we were going to even see some of the things. So I was very skeptical we were going to see a lot of the things that we saw this session. So there you go. Now, next week, we'll be back with another podcast and some new polling data that captures Texans' views of the issues that were before the sessions, the redistricting fight, lots of other stuff. We just got that data, so we'll be turning it over and preparing the material on the website. But I'll talk a little bit more about that a little later in the podcast. So whatever you're doing, keep an eye out next week for that comprehensive release of the polling data. And if you're listening to this, I guarantee you'll be interested in those results. And again, there'll be a little bit of a teaser after the main portion of the podcast, which brings us to this week's podcast. This week, we're bringing you a recording of a panel that I was fortunate to moderate Wednesday afternoon, yesterday at the time I'm recording this, with four close observers of Texas politics, all of whom have been guests on the podcast before. That'd be Gromer Jeffers Jr., the Dallas Morning News, Brad Johnson of The Texan, Mark Jones of the Baker Institute at Rice University, and my friend Harvey Kronberg of The Quorum Report. Now, we recorded the panel, which was convened for a webinar as part of the ongoing series put on by the Professional Advocacy Association of Texas, or PAT, at 2 in the afternoon on Wednesday. So we were talking just as last-minute negotiations over the remaining unresolved bills were very active and ongoing, and there's discussion of that in the pod. We now know that the House and Senate failed to reach an agreement on one of the big priorities that we talked about quite a bit in that webinar, and that's the regulation of THC products, one of the issues that emerged near the end of the regular session and has been percolating in a very kind of unpredictable way, I think, throughout both special sessions. And the session ended without any action on that, which seems to me one of the surprise plot lines of the session. Now, we'll pack a lot more about the session. You know, we packed a lot more about the session, about what got passed, and its implications in this webinar. And we'll talk much more about that when we do a comprehensive review of the new poll results next week. But enjoy the discussion that we had yesterday, which is going to follow this intro. And if you can, cut everybody in there some slack. The conversation took place, you know, amidst, you know, high uncertainty and during this period, while we were trying to figure out what was going on in the negotiations behind closed doors, lucky to have the well-sourced reporters in this discussion. So there are some just-in-time updates as those discussions were going on. And so we didn't know what was finally going to pass of the last clutch of bills that were outstanding and what didn't at the time. But we talked a lot about the dynamics in the legislature. We did some kind of, you know, big picture review. And we talked a bit about the how this was all going to affect the upcoming election season, which, you know, is going to start in earnest, you know, basically now. So I want to thank, like, once again, the folks at PAT, especially Allison Small, for setting up the webinar and graciously allowing us to use the audio for the Second Reading podcast. Be sure to check out PAT's website at pat.org. That's PAAT.org, especially if you're a professional advocate. And many thanks to my colleagues and friends, Gromer, Brad, Mark, and Harvey, for participating and sharing their thoughts. Now, a production note before we play, before we go to the tape. I think I jumped the gun in getting the panel kicked off. So the Zoom recording starts mid-sentence, and I'm sorry about that, but it, you'll be able to tell what's going on. It just kind of starts a little abruptly. But I hope you enjoy it, and I think you will. And to be honest, frankly, I was a little fried after a couple hours of recording lectures for the course that Josh Blank and I are producing at UT this semester. I described it to some people as a little bit loosey-goosey, but I was very fortunate to have a good panel to carry the ball. There's lots of interesting tidbits. We covered a lot of ground, had a good time, and, you know, there are some things you'll find interesting. Listen in particular for Brad Johnson's little nugget about a late lobby hire in trying to kill the bill and successfully killing the bill, I'd say, that would have delayed that big East Texas water project that I'm sure a lot of you have read about. So on that, let's roll tape, and I'll be back on the other side with a preview of some of our polling results. So stay tuned.
Right now, and what's on the table?
Well, supposedly, and I've had it confirmed by two or three sources, the big three got together last night, and the lieutenant governor was adamant that there was going to be a THC bill, and apparently the governor has caved, and but the governor is adamant that there's got to be a property tax bill, and of course we all watched that explode on the floor of the House yesterday. As of this, about 10 o'clock this morning, the thought was that they were not going to sign a die, that they were going to have to come back in order to try to take a bite at those two apples. I'm not sure what changes have taken place inside the property tax bill, if any. And the THC bill that is in play is apparently came out of the governor's office, never went through Ledge Council. Briscoe Cain is carrying it. And people are reading it for the first time and discovering all kinds of, shall we say, deficiencies in the bill. So that's where we're at the moment. If as best I can tell, if they actually do have to come back, it wouldn't surprise me if somebody got up to do a privilege motion to sign a die and see what happens. We'll see.
So Brad, what are you hearing?
Well, Harvey, on that Cain bill, if I recall correctly, it's what, like 175 pages long?
Exactly.
Yeah. So of course everyone's frantically trying to work their way through it. I lucked out. I don't have to parse through the words on every page of that. There was talk about the big three did meet yesterday. The meeting that I'm aware of was in the afternoon after SB 10 fell apart, lasted for about 2 hours. There was no staff in there. It was just those three. And they were talking about landing the plane generally on this session, but particularly THC. And that had been put off, really, this entire second special session, first to get redistricting across the line, then to get flooding across the line. There was a bit of a break between Charles Perry and Drew Darby on SB1 and HB1, which one to go with. Eventually, they settled on doing both. There's been conflict at every step here in this special. And we saw two things blow up yesterday, the property tax bill that Harvey mentioned, but also HB8, the STAR test was supposed to, STAR test elimination was supposed to be brought up to concur with Senate amendments in the House. It was clear there weren't the votes for it. And so Brad Buckley pulled it. Then you have the THC stuff. Public Health put out a committee notice of a potential formal meeting. It wasn't a formal notice, but it was, hey, be ready to vote this or to meet this evening in a formal on some substitutes that I haven't seen yet. And now it sounds like, as Harvey and I were talking before this, sounds like that's all out the window and things are collapsing. So as always with this stuff, at the last hour, it's a constantly developing situation. It kind of reminds me of 2023 on the last day of session when they were trying to come to an agreement on property taxes and went until the very last moment. And then they realized, oh, we got no deal, and adjourned, and then came back the next day. So we'll see if that happens or if they come back in October. I think everything's fluid at this point.
I think that's a comparison that's making people's stomach do when turn over uncomfortably in our audience, but we'll see. You know what? You know, I'm really curious, and I have not been privy to much. I'm going to ask you guys, what is the problem with, you know, the flooding bill? What, you know, what is the point of disagreement there? I mean, that's one of the things that I would have thought was going to be a little bit of lower hanging fruit. Do you know what the hang up is there?
On SB1, HB1?
Yeah.
Oh, those are the camp regulations. The question is how strict do we go against them?
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I got to tell you, I think this second special session is a microcosm of the problem with Texas regular and special sessions. Regular session is only 140 days, special session 30 days. And then you try to cram complex issues in at the last minute. And sometimes you just can't do it. I mean, even with the flooding, I mean, you got to be careful about regulations you set. You know, THC, I mean, is it, can you ever get past the concerns the governor originally had? And property taxes, you know, the activists are calling for the elimination of property taxes. And, you know, that's not feasible. But so I just think that at some point, you got to realize it takes more time to do some of these things. And maybe it's best to come back when you have more.
So you know, I guess what I was thinking, and I, you know, I wasn't looking at my notes, but, you know, but the disaster relief funding bill hasn't gone all the way through yet either, has it? Is an SB 5 still pending?
Yeah, I mean, I haven't seen that pass yet, but I think they're in agreement on it that just hasn't gotten across the line. I don't know if that's being used as leverage for something or if it's, they know it's going to pass, so let's not waste the precious time right now passing it when we can do it very quickly at the end. But yeah, I think you're right.
Stand together, Brad, for the big news conference. You know,
right. Well,
you need to get the stagecraft ready.
Well, there's an interesting piece of that. And Harvey, I'm sure you're going to want to jump in there. But I mean, I guess, you know, and I'm thinking about this way too simplistically, but going into this, it's like, you know, we kind of figured that because of the sequencing related to redistricting and the quorum break and all that, that the disaster response bills would have to wait until after redistricting. But it does seem that, a little bit to your point, Gromer, that they've left what should have been, to me, the high priority bills that they would have wanted to make sure that they didn't leave to the last minute are now sitting there.
Yeah.
That does seem to be a function partially of how redistricting impacted the sequencing and prioritization and agenda management. Barb, go ahead.
Sorry. That was the original promise, was that the first thing after redistricting in both chambers was going to be dealing with the floods and the disaster. And it was very slow moving through the Senate, which led to, as we all know, the lieutenant governor likes to take hostages. And at least the theory floating around the Capitol was he was holding that, making that go slow so he would have some kind of leverage on THC, which then led to a subsequent, why don't we just sign a die and let him explain why flood bills died? But that would require some spying that seems to be absent in process these days.
Well, you know, that's an interesting observation. I mean, you know, I don't want to get into, you know, whose spine is where or whatever, but I would say, you know, that does bring us to this property tax matter where we're seeing, you know, a lot of spine here almost to a fault. Hey, Mark, you know, somebody tell us a little bit about, you know, you're in, and I think different people could see this different ways. What is going on with this property tax bill? Some pretty, the discussion of that on the House floor was pretty remarkable this week.
Wow. One of the most combustible, and it wasn't partisan. You know, the Democrats coalesced with the Mitch Littles of the world. And I think there were two points of contention. One was that most of their constituents would see a $12 a year property tax benefit, which would be an embarrassment to go home and explain or justify. And second was the House passed amendments that carved out public safety and law enforcement, and the Senate rejected them. And in a moment of eloquence, Trey Martinez Fisher gets up yesterday and says, you're not voting against the property tax relief bill. You're voting against the fact that the Senate didn't take any of our sensible amendments.
I think I would probably add to that, Harvey, not so much that it was not partisan, but that the refraction of partisanship in that debate was very, very interesting. Yeah. Brad, how did you read all that?
Well, you know, of course it was going to, the proposal itself was pretty mild. You know, it's a continuation, a minor continuation of what happened in 2019, the voter approval limits that were placed on these localities. And this would just drop the cities and counties, at least those above 75,000 population, to the same VATER, voter approval tax rate line that ISDs currently have, which is 2.5%. So we're just seeing a 1% drop. You know, I think that's something. And it, for people who want to curtail property tax increases, it is a step in the right direction. The question is it sufficient? And you know, this was always going to be more minor of an adjustment, particularly if they didn't go with what Governor Abbott wanted, which was originally a two-thirds vote line to pass any property tax increase whatsoever. And that's gone nowhere, not in the regular session, not in the specials. So they've kind of settled on this more minor adjustment. And it kind of got, because it was in a special, it became the marquee item on the property tax issue, when really the biggest adjustment they made was during the regular session. It's when they raised the homestead exemption significantly for both standard homeowners and elderly and disabled. They added more money in compression, although it's not as much as they put in during the 23 session. So I think it's this has fallen victim to a branding problem compared with what happened in the regular session. And then it butts up with, Gromer mentioned that eliminate property tax calls. And, you know, unless you want to really raise the sales tax, which we've seen collapse in years past, 2019, that comes to mind, then it's not feasible. It's not economically, financially feasible. So you have these two demands on each side. And the question of letting the perfect be the enemy of the good, or is this just so minor that it's not really useful at all? All these different viewpoints were clashing on the House floor. And that's why we saw kind of a horseshoe theory develop, where you have the Democrats and the right wingers side together on this. It was interesting to see play out. And it was even more interesting to see Betancourt giving a tongue lashing to the House members who went over to try to negotiate.
And Brad, it also shows you the importance of messaging, and how if you have a message out there that people gravitate toward, but they distort, then you can be in some trouble, because they keep promising meaningful property tax relief and they're going to do all that they can. And then, you know, folks start pushing for what you can't give them. And then therein lies a problem.
Yeah. I mean, it seems to me, go ahead, Brad, go ahead.
I would say that there's another angle to that too, in that, you know, the 23 reforms were called, I'm only exaggerating slightly, the greatest property tax in the history of the universe.
That's right.
The greatest. And, you know, if that's what we're making our best ever line at, you know, how can you improve upon that, really? You know, it's just a failure of, like you said, of, in this case, positive messaging.
Yeah. Well, 2025 was the super greatest. So, Mark, what are you making of this? Welcome. And what do you make of this kind of property tax fight? You have anything you would add to that? I mean, I have a couple of thoughts, but.
Well, I mean, I think it shows the ability of, you know, when you have the fringes, or at least the edges, can block something. They can't come to an overall agreement. That is, the reason they're blocking it is different. That is, they have different opposition, or I guess, disagreements with it. But they can both agree that for this bill, on this occasion, we're going to unite together to scuttle it. Although what the Tony Tenderholtz and Mitch Littles of the world want would be diametrically opposed to what many of the Democrats would want in terms of the reasons why they're going against it. You know, at the end of the day, the clock is running. So, and I think, as you know, Brad was mentioning, that the stakes here are pretty modest if we're thinking about overall tax relief. So it may be something that the incentive or the benefits from compromising aren't high enough to essentially let either side essentially stake a claim to it, particularly sort of from the more conservative House Republican side, that there may just be the sense that it's better to walk away with the credit for having continued to push for property tax relief rather than to give in on something that very few people are going to really notice as being meaningful property tax relief, in part because it's so indirect and you'll have to explain it to them. Well, had it not been for this legislation, then your tax bill last year would have gone up by $4 or $8. And
yeah,
that's not a particularly effective message to send to voters.
Well, and in fact, people were using that in the House debate as, you know, I don't want to say a knife or anything, but it was certainly a sharp poker to poke at people for their attachment to this. So is there a, what, you know, is there a solution? What is the solution looking like? Last I heard, you know, the Senate, you know, Betancourt does not want to give. And it feels a little bit to me, to go back to, you know, some of the things that Brad and Hart, that all of you were saying, that the Republican majority is kind of snatching defeat from the jaws of victory here in terms of the ability after 2025, whatever you think of the policy, to say, yeah, we came back after we gave you tax relief in 2023, we came back in 2025 and gave you supercalifragilistic tax relief. And they could have exited the field and declared victory, and yet did not.
And not only declare victory, you can say, here's more tax relief, and we're going to keep going. We're going to keep at it. We're going to keep.
But I think that's what got him in trouble, right? Yeah. Was the keep at it part.
Well, you know, I think the point that you can always improve is a good point to make. But you just can't promise things like abolishing or, you know, two-thirds vote in some sense.
And I think the dollar amount of what we've committed to as a state to do property tax relief right now is about $51 billion.
Exactly.
Which is, that is a hell of a commitment.
It's extraordinary.
Okay, yeah. So tell me, what else are you guys are watching of the things that are unresolved that you think, you know, are going to be the big sticking points here in the next, you know, whatever the reporting turns out to be right in the next 12 to 24 hours or 36 hours, you know, is it the STAR test? Is it, you know, what is it out there that is going to be explosive?
I think and another question, what will be left undone when the music stops?
Sure.
What will still be hanging
out
there?
Add that on, Groomer.
Yeah, and I maybe THC, maybe. I mean, flood, they're going to land that, right? And they're going to STAR test probably, but I don't know if they can get to THC, at least to mollify Patrick and Abbott. But we'll see.
I'm sorry, go ahead, Mark.
Well, no, I think THC is the real one to watch because it's also the one that if nothing happens, the status quo is considered pretty undesirable by a lot of people. You know, sometimes there's legislation that it doesn't pass, but let's say banning taxpayer-funded lobbyists. Well, you know, for a small segment of the population, that's you know, an issue, but it's not the end of the world.
The small segment that happens to be our audience, but
for them, but by and large, if taxpayer-funded lobbying doesn't pass, it's like no one's really. It's not going to be a big thing. THC, though, if that doesn't pass, then you get this status quo that the lieutenant governor, the governor, and many others, and even most people on the Democratic side, said was a bad status quo. That is, that the current, the current status of having all these dispensaries, having them be completely unregulated, having some of them perhaps be good actors, I don't know, maybe they just had better marketing, and some of them clearly being bad actors, selling products that are illegal and dangerous, to allow that to simply go on for another 2+ years because you can't come to an agreement, I mean, that's not a good policy outcome for a Republican majority that should, if they can should be able to come to some compromise agreement that allows them to do something that changes the status quo. Because if you don't change the status quo, all of the problems that the lieutenant governor talked about, and others have talked about, will continue for the next 2 years. And if anything, the industry will become larger and more entrenched.
Well, the core question on that, as I see it, is, you know, I think at this point is, who is, you know, I mean, Harvey said that, the, you know, was reporting that the governor had folded, but it does seem to me that it's, you know, who is going to give just a little on this? Will the lieutenant governor accept something less than a total ban?
Remember, there are two items on the call. One is a total ban for anyone under 21 years old, on which there's near universal agreement. And the rest is some kind of regulation, which really gets pretty squirrely and dicey pretty quickly. I think it was Landgraf would not accept a standalone bill with a 21-year age ban, which would be a significant improvement, obviously, and something that people could go home with. They wanted it folded into a larger bill, but there are still two separate items on the call that one could be satisfied pretty easily, one less so.
Well,
Will
Patrick accept that only a ban that under 21? I mean, at his news conference, you remember when he was throwing things around, he pointed out that, yeah, you know, adults get high
likely to drop
as well.
Brad, you were going to jump in there a minute ago, I thought.
Yeah. On the THC stuff, you know, if there's nothing done this time around, you'll have to do it in 27, or Patrick will have to try again. And by then, you know, the industry will not be taken by surprise like they were this time. And they're already gearing up for lawsuits. But, you know, if 2 years go by and we're back talking about this, you know, imagine the lobby presence that's going to be had by the THC industry. You know, maybe not quite on par with the casino gambling presence, but, well, you know,
that's a high bar.
Yeah. I mean, if I'm in the industry and I'm faced with extinction, of course I'm going to shell out for a full court press, you know? So,
I mean, they've done a pretty impressive job given the surprise that you talked about.
Yeah. Well, it was an existential threat to their existence. So, you know, I think they really, you know, as Brad was saying, they have to pull out all the stops. They had to pull out every sympathetic veteran who likes to go down to the corner store, the Valero, and essentially self-medicate and, you know, could say, call that, you know, medical marijuana. But, you know, they pulled out all the stops and they were, I think, effective, at least in getting the governor. You know, the nut to crack, of course, is the lieutenant governor, but the lieutenant governor is now in a bind, in that if he doesn't yield, then he is effectively condemning, if, you know, condemning would be perhaps his term, or at least a term. If you take his worldview of this industry and its negative and pernicious effects on the population, then not coming to any agreement this session is condemning Texas to two more years of the status quo, and more likely than not, you know, even further, because it's going to be tougher and tougher to rein it in as it grows larger. And, you know, I don't, you know, it's different somewhat of in the metroplex here in Houston with our lack of zoning. It's, yeah, it's pretty insane the number of places we have around.
And where you run into them.
Yeah. There is a political element that we shouldn't forget too. And that is that when Abbott has rarely outpolled, had a higher approval rating than Dan Patrick among the Republican primary voters. And at least most of the polling seems to indicate that when he vetoed the ban, he surged maybe double digits above in terms of approval over. You seem skeptical.
Yeah, well, we'll see. We'll have fresh data soon. But
well, yeah, we just did a poll on that with Republican primary voters. It really depends on how you phrase it. And so if you pitch it to Republican primary voters as recreational marijuana, everyone's with the lieutenant governor, 2/3 of them. If you pitch it as medical marijuana, then they're more with the industry. And so it's really, you know, it's like, it really depends heavily on the narrative that's used. It's like, if you really say that this is effectively children buying buying marijuana, and effectively we're becoming just like Colorado and California, then Republican primary voters are with the lieutenant governor. But if you pitch it as veterans getting access to needed medication, then, you know, the Republican primary voters are more with the group that wants to essentially block the ban or at least limit the regulation.
Yeah, and I think nobody should be surprised by that, right? I mean, you know, we always say question wording matters. I mean, people always say, well, if you'd asked it differently, and we always go, well, yeah. But, you know, in this case, I mean, I was struck by the poll that the Lieutenant Governor's office released the Mike Vassily's kind of a message testing poll that was kind of reflected that knowledge that Mark is alluding to there about what people respond to and what they don't. But in that poll, even what was for that poll, the negative message was, should you just, I'm being a little bit loose here, but not too, you know, or do you think that we should control these products that are harming children and et cetera, et cetera? Or should we just let Texans exercise their liberty? And I think the phrase was to just get high, but you still had 33% going, yeah, we should just let people get high. So I think there's really a limit to that. And it's kind of what's floating through, what's really making this so difficult. You know, I mean, you know, the playing it straight kind of polling that I know Mark has done some of this, we have, where you kind of keep as much of the hot button terms out of there other than saying, you know, do you want people, do you want this to be banned? Do you want it to be completely free? Do you want medical? The middle territory, the middle zones of that attitudinally has been where the sweet spot has been. Availability of medical, and particularly among Republicans, availability of medical marijuana and regulated. I mean, I remain a little bit struck by what a big deal this has become, I gotta say. I mean, if you had asked me a couple of years ago, in the late summer of 2025, will there be the legislature be tied up over Delta 8 and Delta 9 with, you know, things just coming to a crashing halt potentially because of it? I would have been pretty surprised, honestly, but, you know, been wrong about a lot of things. It's not new. Okay, what else should be watching, guys, before we go on to some more big picture considerations that are seeping in anyway?
One issue that's definitely not on the level as a policy issue of these other ones we've talked about, but I find it very fascinating and interesting, is this East Texas water fight. You know, Cody Harris's HB 27 passed the House and moved over to the Senate. As it passed the House, it was both a study on extraction of groundwater in aquifers in East Texas and a moratorium on two specific permits that have been requested by, I think he lives in Dallas, DFW millionaire Kyle Bass, who owns a conservation equity firm. And he has threatened to sue the legislature if they pass this to stop it. Harris wants a study done to see the actual effects on this. And more than that, he wants the permit applications to cease for the time being. And it's this classic rural Texas versus urban Texas water fight that we see play out all the time. Marvin Nichols Reservoir is one that continues to pop up. This one's a new one. But when it went over to the Senate, the Senate stripped out the moratorium or the halting the applications and just kept as the study. So we'll see what Harris does on the floor today when we get to that point. But the Senate is against that. And I think uncoincidentally, if you look at Texas Ethics Commission filings, as of yesterday, Kyle Bass hired Alan Blakemore as his lobbyist for the Conservation Equity Management Company. Yeah. I mean,
good work if you
find Bass. Of course I do that. Of course I hire the guy who has the key to the Senate. It may work. It looks like it worked in the Senate so far. I'm not sure the House can actually match that, but dang, that was, when I first heard that happened, I was like, holy crap, that's an all in move, by Bass, and it might pay off.
What else you guys watching? Grummer? Have we hit your main points, or is there anything else you're kind of thinking about?
I mean, that's pretty much it. And the only other thing I'm watching is what will the mood be of lawmakers going into the 2026 political season, and will something that happens in the next few hours sort of cause havoc in the primaries, particularly Republican primaries coming up? And that
excellent transition. So what do we think? Mark, what looms over the 2026 primaries coming out of this session? You know, set us up for that discussion, because I think everybody's going to have thoughts on that.
Well, I think actually, you know, when we go back to the regular session, we didn't have a lot of the drivers of Republican internal conflict that we've had in the past, or disputes over the speaker, or a conflict between the speaker and sort of the conservative wing of the party, school choice bills with the governor getting involved, not even, you know, Sarah Davis, and her, donation scandal, or her donation limits on the attempts to go after the governor on that. We haven't had any of the drivers of sort of challenges to incumbents. And with a lot of people getting behind the incumbents that supported school choice across the board, I think we're looking at, on the Republican side, a much lower key primary process than we've had in the past, where you still will have some challengers. There will still be some groups out there sort of going after the moderates in particular, and we'll have some open seats. But I think across the board, I think we're probably looking at a tamer Republican primary season than we've had in the past. And even with Dade Phelan not seeking reelection, that's, one potential challenge is gone. And is everybody are gang up on Gary Van Diver? I mean, he's shown he can survive. So I think the action this time around on the primaries will be less at the state house, the state Senate level, except for we have some open seats, and more at the congressional level and those statewide races on the Republican side, with the U.S. Senate race, the Texas Attorney General race, the controller race, that'll be the real drivers of interest this cycle, as opposed to, in 2023 and to a lesser extent 2021. In 2024 and in 2022, we saw a lot more focus on the lower level races as sort of drivers.
And I think Trump's endorsements of a lot of those House members takes the steam out of any sort of opposition there.
Yeah, the Trump blanket endorsement after the bill kind of, was pretty helpful. After the voucher bill was pretty helpful. Brad, does that make sense to you? I'm wondering, because you've got your head in a lot of these very, ground level races at the state house.
It certainly will not be what it was last year in terms of, the multi-front war in the legislature. But I see two big crosswinds that are going to be fascinating to watch. The first is the thing we've been watching every cycle. They're doubling down now, is the casino gambling lobby pushing very heavily for, seats gained in both chambers. And look at the SD9 race. That is a proxy fight on gambling expansion or legalization, if I've ever seen one. You can see the ads running on TV right now. We saw Miriam Adelson put $9 million into her Las Vegas Sands PAC, and then another $9 million into the Texas Defense PAC, which is kind of their independent expenditure group. They're going to play heavily in this because they lost ground this year in the legislature, and I don't think they can afford another session in 27 without gaining some of that ground back, if not all of it, and advancing the ball further. I think they've realized they're not going anywhere while Patrick is in office, but they're trying to wait him out. But even so, they can't end up with with less ground than they used to have when that does come open and they potentially get a lieutenant governor that's amenable. The other one that I'm watching is this tort reform fight, TLR versus the trial, the personal injury attorneys, and kind of the mix of political grudge match and policy fight that we see converging there. We saw during the regular session, we're going to see it next year. TLR is going to, from what I understand, go pretty heavily at some of these Republicans that went against them, but also try and protect the members that were loyal to them on that that nuclear verdicts shell of a bill vote that they had. Those two things are going to, first of all, inject tons of money into these races. And second of all, if the two sides, if the casino lobby on one side and TLR on the other, that did lose ground in the legislature this year, or at least didn't end up with what they wanted, are they successful in what is probably going to be a more typical election cycle than what we saw last year in 24 because of all this stuff that was happening? So
a little more multidimensional.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that makes sense to me.
I'd add that there's some internal conflict over at TLR as to what track to take. The board is now one of the reasons Trabulsi was essentially booted, as I understand it, was that with a $30+ million PAC, they need to punish or at least make it expensive to defend some seats. Some of those seats are held by MAGA Republicans with Trump endorsements. And the board was divided as to how intensely they should go after those folks. And at least as of now, I think that still remains somewhat unresolved. And we'll see. But if you don't demonstrate some muscle, then you give up position on the field. And it seems to me that ultimately they do have to at least inflict some pain for or some cost for recalcitrant Republicans. And then on a broader picture, it's worth mentioning with all these congressional seats, with the additional congressional seats, obviously there's going to be some movement that we haven't seen yet. But it's worth noting that, and Gromer will like this, I think, the map was drawn based on Trump 2024 votes, which is kind of like that was a high water mark for Republicans, I would say. Democrats pretty much abandoned the field. It's kind of like using Beto's numbers in 2018 as a baseline for Democratic participation, which I made that mistake in looking at what was going to happen in 2020. Using Trump vote as the baseline, 15 of those congressional seats are 60% or less Republican. Considering that there was no Democratic turnout to speak of, that suggests that they might be somewhere between 54% and 57% Republican seats, realistically, which does get to be competitive. And in 2018, which was the high water mark for Democrats, they gained a surprising 12 House seats in that race. I'm not predicting anything, obviously. I'm just saying the numbers are somewhat compelling.
Yeah.
Potential numbers are somewhat compelling.
Yeah. Mark and I have talked about this a lot. I mean, what does it look like? Does it look like a 2018 race or does it look like a 2024 race? I mean, Trump is not on a ballot and he has the negatives that the party that controls the White House has historically in midterm elections. And I do agree with you, Harvey, in South Texas, in the Valley, I'm not so sure that the redistricting there will work. It'll work up here in North Texas. I mean, the Democrats will lose a seat up here. I mean, District 32 is gone. But those seats in South Texas, I'm not so sure about that.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I think that, I mean, definitely the idea of flipping 28 with Cuellar or 34 with Gonzalez hinges really on the electorate looking like the 2024 electorate and voting like the 2024 electorate, which seems unlikely. So
right.
Those are going to be those are sort of the two real reaches that I think if we were betting, if I were doing even money bet, I would bet with Cuellar and Gonzalez. The real question marks for me are 9 here in Houston and 35, San Antonio and Guadalupe. Those are two counties, or those are two districts that, you know, in a good election for Republicans with good candidates, they pick it up. But in a good election for Democrats, something more approaching 2018 with good nominees, they picked it up. And I think their candidate quality is likely to matter some in a sort of intermediate election year where a good San Antonio Democrat who's not too far to the left and has, you know, the ability to campaign could win. And likewise in Houston here with 9, a good Democrat going up against a Republican, depending on which, and we have a couple of different Republican options here, one a little more difficult or in the general than the other. Those two seats I think are going to be up in the air. I think, you know, the worst case scenario for Republicans is probably you end up with a net zero. That is, you get 32, as Gromer mentioned. There's no way that Republicans are going to lose 32. But in a bad year, Monica de la Cruz hasn't been shored up. I mean, her district is still, if we do see sort of South Texas shift back more blue, she's likely to get swept up. Tony Gonzalez is a little safer, but we could end up with a scenario in a bad election year for Republicans that after all of the redistricting hoopla, the gnashing of teeth, the quorum break, we end up with a net Republican gain of zero.
I'll add that on our partisan index that we have, we rated these new seats. The Gonzalez seat, 34, does move towards Republicans slightly. It goes to R51%, so that is a very slight Republican lean. And then the Cuellar seat actually gets more Democratic. It goes from D51 to D53. Yeah. You know, the Republicans are counting on the Hispanic shift that we have seen growing for the majority party since 2016. And obviously last year is when we saw the biggest returns on that, but they're counting on that continuing. And who knows if that does continue, because they're Trump districts, but Henry Cuellar still won in that election last year, right?
And Trump's not on the ballot.
Trump's not on the ballot. Yeah.
And look, Henry Cuellar is such a wild card. I mean, I don't know how you can't really even consider him in this. Oh, this is what a Democrat looks like in that district. And the other wild card in there is, you know, that I think people have alluded to indirectly, I think, but is pretty clear in our data, and I think it shows up in Mark's data too, is that, you know, the overall trend here is not that that Hispanics or Latinos are moving decisively in the direction, you know, of becoming Republicans, but that they, as a group, have weaker party attachments. And, you know, the other piece of that is if you look at Trump's favorability numbers among Latinos in Texas, he peaked at just the right time. That is, you know, his favorability ratings among Latinos were the highest in October of 2024, and they've been going back down in a more familiar direction ever since then. And that puts, you know, that puts some of these assumptions into question, and I think is a countervailing factor here. I want to, you know, go ahead. Yeah.
I was just going to toss a question out. Does anybody think that, you know, right now, my understanding is that Schumer is all in with Allred as the Senate Democratic nominee, but we're all hearing that Tallarico may end up announcing sometime in the near future. Does up ballot make any difference as far as down ballot goes with these congressional races or House races for that matter? I tend to think it does. I think Allred didn't carry the banner well the first time, and there's no reason to think that it would do any better this time. And Tallarico, if he does get in, has been in combat. He's one of the two most articulate and persuasive members of the House Democratic Caucus. So, and would bring new voters to the polls, but kind of curious.
Well, theoretically, but we've heard that before.
Yeah, as Burka used to say, anybody that believes that new voters are going to make, he has a term for anybody that believes new voters are going to make the difference. It's called loser.
Yeah. But with those, we have Winnie Davis and the suburban Anglo-Democratic women.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, I think these candidate centric theories can, you know, are often a little bit overblown. You look at the O'Rourke election, and yes, O'Rourke was a better than average Democratic candidate, but boy, he was, you know, a slightly faster than usual boat dropped into a very fast moving stream, you know, flowing the direction he wanted to go, to just torture the hell out of that metaphor. But, you know, well, I think that structure versus agent issue is very, very tricky when we were looking at these things.
You know, the 18 cycle, of course, Beto had the benefit of running against Ted Cruz.
Yeah.
And A, Ted Cruz is not on the ballot this time. B, you know, they're banking a lot of their hopes on Ken Paxton being the nominee, which it looks like on balance he probably will be at this point. Although, I mean, you guys are the pollsters. You let me know if it's accurate or not that the race is getting closer. But there's a lot of expectation that Ken Paxton will have the same problem that Ted Cruz did. I don't think I buy that. Ken Paxton is a far lesser known figure on the national level than Cruz was back then. So is he as big of a foil to bring in that much money? Maybe, maybe not. But I also don't think he's less significantly, you know, as unlikable as Cruz was in 18. I've seen the guy.
He's not as well known.
Hold on. I mean, have you ever seen him work a room? He's very good at it.
Yeah, no.
It's his best skill. He's very good at it. So Ted Cruz doesn't have that.
Oh, yeah.
And,
but what happens after Democrats dump in $75 to $100 million telling us everything bad there is to know about Ken Paxton. And it's an open question. We've never had an election where anybody's done that among general election voters. It's clear Republican primary voters don't care. He alert, burned about $10 million to come to that conclusion. We haven't tested with general election voters because Justin Nelson, Rochelle Garza, and Sam Houston combined, I don't think, spent over $1 million in the general election. So we don't know what'll happen. And I think for national Democrats, you're more likely to get national Democrats involved in this race just because of the national structure. If they're thinking about having any hope of flipping the U.S. Senate, Texas is really one of the, they got Maine, Ohio, North Carolina, but they need one more, and it's going to be Iowa or Texas. So they may burn money in here, even if it's a long shot, simply because they don't have anywhere else to spend it. So, and now, we could find out that the lesson is general election voters in Texas don't care. You can inundate them with everything from, biblical divorces to stolen pens to, and the like, and into Uber accounts with, fake names. And the voters won't care, but that's an open question. And for the first time, Democrats will have the ability to educate general election voters about it. We just don't know what the effect will be.
Yeah, I think the issue with that, Mark, is that, as you kind of allude to, none of that is going to be news by the time we get to the general election. Now, I would also say that, my answer to kind of Brad's question about the race is that we don't really know now because, in my view, this isn't a race for, it's a race for us. But for most voters right now, it's not a race. They're not thinking about it. They have some views of these two guys. They're being, we can talk about primary voters and that's appropriate. But in terms of thinking about the general election audience, but even to some degree, a lot of primary voters, people are just not paying attention to this yet. And a lot of attitudes are yet to be formed. And they're going to start being formed as we speak. We're after Labor Day. Yeah. The money's getting spent. And we'll see more happening going forward from about this moment forward. But so much of that is still unformed that I don't know. But I do think that the Democrats could spend a lot of money re-raising Paxton's negatives, but it's still going to be very dependent on what the baseline environment looks like when we get to next August, September, October. And I don't know.
Yeah, it's a perfect storm type metaphor. That is, Paxton's liabilities as a candidate only matter if things nationally are trending very negatively for Republicans. If it's a decent election year for Republicans, all that means is that he wins by 6 or 7% instead of by 10%. You need a whole combination of things. You need Trump's approval going down. You need the economy going down. And at that point, the liabilities of Paxton could allow Democrats to cross it. But it requires a lot of other things to happen in the interim. And for Republicans and Democrats also to nominate a competitive candidate that could, we've tested, but we don't really know about Tallarico. And so, I think one of the things we're going to start to see about Tallarico if he announces is, what negative is there out there about Tallarico? Because the only thing we've been hearing about Tallarico now is pretty much positive press about him. There a few things are filtering out, but no one's gone and done a dive of, okay, what's the negative story that you can do on Tallarico? Maybe there isn't anything, but some of the coverage is probably going to be a little less spawning than it's been today.
Yeah, and that it doesn't even have to be a real negative, right? As we've seen. Gromer, anybody else want to weigh in on 2026? I want to get to, before we run out of time. We're getting close. I just want to ask this. So I had Ross Ramsey on our podcast last week, and my setup for Ross was kind of, the legislature, it's been a very, with the quorum break, the response to the quorum break, a lot of the things that we've been talking about in terms of the interactions, the mood on the floor of the both chambers, but especially the House. There's kind of a, every session has its own kind of unique flavor. And there's always a temptation for people like us to kind of go, this is unique. This is the watershed. Things have changed. And I'm kind of wondering, are we going to look back on this session and say, this was kind of the watershed where, the last, no more Democratic chairs, where the the bipartisan or polarization really dug in and changed the institutions. you know, are we feeling like we're in a big change, or is it just another where we're in a pressure point, we're all too close to it, it's all myopic to see big structural change?
I think
it's kind of your closing statement. So
I think it's more of the same. I think it's a continuation of where we've been. I mean, each session and each election cycle, the state tends to get more and more Republican now, and until Democrats do something to change that narrative, I think this is a natural progression. We saw in 2024 Abbott get really involved in primary elections. That was kind of different. But I think now we're easing back to a situation where Republicans are in control. They're activists, the people on the their activists are trying to sort of hold them accountable, and you see what goes on with that. But for the most part, Texas is a Republican state. To what degree is competitive, that's still the question. And until it gets more competitive, you're going to see sessions where the Republicans flex their muscle.
Garvey?
I think the...
I'm going to the order that I see you guys. I don't know. What, yeah. So.
The House, I mean, half the House is freshmen or sophomores. And the governor parachuting into the primaries really altered in some ways, it seems to me, the composition. Most freshmen come in thinking they represent an ideology more than they represent a district. And I don't know if it's a sea change, but kind of the bench, not the benchmark, but the metaphor for this legislative session was ideology prevailed over any sense of consensus, and districts became more marginal. Representing your district became more marginal than representing your ideology.
Brad?
I think there was certainly the opportunity for Republicans in the House to coalesce behind Burroughs. And I think it's still very possible, if not very likely, that he wins the caucus nomination in December 26. But Republicans are still 80 or 12 seats away from a supermajority. And unless you get significantly closer to that, you're going to have a coalition government in the House to some degree. And now it might be with, the entire Republican caucus or most of it.
An internal Republican coalition, right?
Right. With the moderate Democrats in South Texas. But that's still a coalitional style government. It's just very difficult to prevent, for lack of a better term, a Joe Strauss play, where you get a small amount of Republicans and the entire Democratic caucus. It's difficult to keep that entirely out of the question. There's a question. It's always going to be talked about. It was being talked about Travis Clardy trying it a couple years ago with Thielen. Never went anywhere, but because it was being talked about, it was then part of the thinking of leadership, right? And so I don't see, even with this remarkable year that we've had in the redistricting that unified Republicans and Democrats more than we've seen in a while, with the speaker being a lot more conservative in what he passed than what many people thought he would at the beginning of session, it's still, the numbers are still the numbers. And if you don't have a supermajority, it's very hard for the majority party to just run roughshod over the minority party and elect their own speaker without any say from Democrats.
Mark?
Yeah, well, a lot of points I was going to make have been taken, so I'm going to shift to something that hasn't been talked about. I'll make one thing about, I think one issue that is increasingly we see in the Republican Party with representing the district versus sort of ideology is, the more these districts get crammed into the larger urban areas, and the more they're sort of geographically contorted to provide a benefit for Republicans, I think the more ideological you tend to see them go, because the way you win is in the Republican primary, and you win that not by representing the district, but by representing ideology. As you get out state, that's a little less, but that's an increasingly small share. So I think that's an issue. That's, I think, one of the factors that sort of is pushing this sort of issue of ideology, is simply because that's the route to victory. It's being seen as the most conservative in your district in the Republican primary. And the other thing I think would point out, and this is sort of as we're looking at 2026, we've talked at the very top of the ballot, with the U.S. Senate race. And of course, then we have the U.S. House race. But below that is a gubernatorial race where we still don't have a Democrat. And so there, the Democrats are in this conundrum of who wants to be the sacrificial ram that runs up against Greg Abbott. And so, who do they find, or do they adopt a strategy of the best strategy is to have Greg Abbott say that he doesn't really need to work very hard because that could help us with down ballot races. But the complete absence of any gubernatorial candidates, and it could be both a plus and a minus for the Democratic Party, depending on how you look at it. It's a minus in the sense that it's a high profile position where you would ideally perhaps want a good candidate. On the other hand, you really don't perhaps want Greg Abbott bringing his A game to this election in terms of mobilizing and turnout. And, thus far, even at the lieutenant governor level, thus far, we have Vicki Goodwin, who three quarters of Democratic primary voters have no idea who she is, let alone regular voters. So, it's not exactly murderer's row for the Democrats once you get out of that Senate race competition.
Abbott has nearly $100 million already in his campaign fund. And remember, in 2018, he helped pull Ted Cruz across the finish line. It's a tough position. Do you poke Abbott and activate that spending, or do you hope that he takes his money and tries to save it?
Yeah, I was thinking that in terms of your response. I mean, I don't think you're wrong, Mark, but I kind of agree with Groomer in the sense of Democrats don't really have a good choice in that.
No, they don't.
period.
No, they don't.
I appreciate all your, I want to hand this back to Allison because we're getting close and there's no questions in the chat, but Allison, if you want us to cover anything else in the last 2 minutes or whatever, please. So thank you.
This has been great. Y'all are always informative and entertaining and slightly scary at times. So it's all good. And we got a Ross Ramsey shout out. So it was good to hear his name. Well, we appreciate everyone for being on. And our next event that we have scheduled is October 1st. We're doing a Lobby 101 webinar, and the link to that is in the chat. But we appreciate it. People have questions after, we'll send the video out and they can feel free to send it to us. We can answer it or follow up with you guys to answer.
Or something.
Yes, exactly. All right, well, appreciate it. Thank you all very much.
Thank you.
Bye.
Thanks, everybody. See you soon.
Okay, so I hope you enjoyed that. Here's a slight postscript. If you made it this far, I wanted to give you a teaser about the polling data that we'll be releasing next week about public opinion on issues that were on the agenda for the special session. The data was collected mostly last week, so it's pretty fresh from while the session was still in progress. But the major tracks were kind of laid out best as we could tell at the time. Now, in particular, what I want to preview is a set of questions in which we asked respondents to rate the items on the special session call as it existed when we put the poll in the field on August 22nd. And as most of you know, the governor made a few late ads, so we couldn't really include those because we can't time travel. We don't have a Tony Stark's time travel GPS. Now, in this battery of questions, we gave people a series of items that characterized what was on the special session call in pretty even-handed language, and asked people to tell us how important they thought they were, and then subsequently we asked them to say what was the most important. But we'll set that aside for next week. Now, of the proposals that we gave people, four of them were ranked extremely or very important by 50% or more of the registered voters that we polled. And we polled 1,200 registered voters between August 22nd and August 31st. So this is what we got. This is the four proposals that were more than 50%. Top ranked by far, responding to issues related to the July 4th flood. 55% rated that set of issues extremely important. 27% very important. So 83% combined thought they were either extremely or very important. As you'll see, the most broadly supported measures by far. Ranked second behind that, attempting to further reduce property taxes. 43% found that extremely important. 27%, very important, for a total of 70%. Next behind that, prohibiting local governments from using public money to hire outside lobbyists. That shortens the phrasing a little bit. The term of art here being taxpayer-funded lobbying. 38% found that extremely important, 26% very important, for a total of 64%. And then the last one above 50%, though it barely made the cut, requiring people to use restrooms that match their birth gender. 36% found that extremely important, 16% very, for a total of 52%. Again, barely makes the cut, and that reflects the partisan attitudes, that measure much more popular among Republicans than among independents or Democrats, but with some support from independents or Democrats, that gets it in the overall rating over that 50% threshold, even if just barely. Now, by my count, if you look at those four things, response to the flood, property taxes, taxpayer-funded lobbying, sorry, friends, and requiring people to use restrooms that match their birth gender, by my count, the ledge went 2 for 4 on these measures. That is, you know, a passage of substantial measures related to the July 4th flood, though I would put an asterisk on that and say they did not pass everything and left a couple of relatively big pieces of legislation on the table. And that is, I think, fueling this conversation that the governor might choose to add another session. But they did pass a lot of major measures on that, so we'll put a pin in that. But we'll give the legislature credit and say that they get credit for that one. The main measure related to property taxes, which would have lowered the threshold for local elections to increase property taxes, went down in flames in a very spectacular way. You just heard discussion of that in the webinar. The general subject of property taxes, very popular. And of course, the legislature did do a lot of that on that front on the regular session. Again, something we discussed in the podcast, but they did not move that legislation. The taxpayer-funded lobbying measure died in committee in the House after passing through the Senate. They didn't get that done. And then they did require an access to public facilities based on biological sex, quote unquote. That did pass. So that's the two. That's why I get this 2 for 4 count. Now, if you look at what was under 50%, in the measures that we tested, you see a lot of things that actually did pass. So, revising congressional maps, redistricting. The redistricting measure found extremely important by 27%, very by 18%, for a total of 45% finding it, you know, very or extremely or very important. Increasing and implementing new abortion restrictions, 21% found that extremely important, 15% very important, 36% clearly there's going to be partisan structure there. Eliminating or replacing the STAR test, 21% extremely important, 21% very important, for a total of 42%. Limiting access to police complaint files, something else that also generated a lot of conflict, but ultimately wound up not passing. That wound up passing, though a key amendment got defeated in the House at the last moment. 19% extremely important, 20% very important, and then comprehensively regulating hemp. 14% extremely important, 18% very important, for a total of 32% support. Now, you look at those, the first four, redistricting, new abortion restrictions, replacing the STAR test, limiting access to police complaint files, all of those passed. And of course, the hemp file, very famously now, did not pass, and they didn't do anything about that. So with these, for these measures that received less than 50% support by this measure, or was, you know, graded this, you know, extremely or very important to be precise for this measure, four of those five measures did pass. So all of those measures, all of the things that were very popular there, the top four, were very popular among Republican voters, much less so. So if you're trying to make some broad judgments here, these were the items that were likely to be much more important, receive much more support by Republican voters, and in particular with most of these measures, particularly the abortion restrictions and the redistricting maps. These are going to be measures that were very strongly supported by the most intense Republicans, that is Republican primary voters. We'll have more detail on that next week when we talk about these results. So I hope you find that interesting, get you interested in what we'll be releasing next week. Keep an eye out if you want to get a heads up on when we actually release that data and get the first gander at the write-up we do on that and the graphics that we'll produce for that next week. You can sign up for our email list at our website. Sign-up forms are all over the website at the bottom of every blog post, and they appear on some of the interior pages. So if you want to sign up for that email list, I would encourage you to do that. All right, that's it for the teaser. So extra thanks to our excellent production crew in the audio studio here in the Liberal Arts Development Studio at UT Austin. We've done a great job stitching together the podcast this week and, you know, dealing with a lot of last minute to and fro. We appreciate you all. Thank you all for listening. And again, watch for the new poll early next week. And we'll be back with another second reading podcast, probably on our regular schedule next week, to talk about results and what it tells us about public opinion, about the watershed session that just ended, and some of the other big issues looming out there as we are now properly in midterm election season. So again, thank you for listening and keep in touch. The Second Reading Podcast is a production of the Texas Politics Project at the University of Texas at Austin.